Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. Some claim that we in a new American Gilded Age, or that a new feudalism is emerging, but it's a gilded feudalism with a difference because it's globalized. Wealth and the wealthy can easily cross national boundaries while walls are being built to hinder the movement of workers and the poor. 30 years ago, in the Reagan era, Lewis Lapham, who was then the editor of Harper's Magazine, wrote about this new Gilded Age in Money and Class in America. And that book is now being reissued in a new paperback edition by O.R. Books with a new foreword by Thomas Frank. Mr. Lapham has also written about related issues of trade and globalization in his introductory essay to the spring issue of his magazine, Lapham's Quarterly. I'm very pleased to welcome Lewis Lapham to our show now for a discussion of the arcs of wealth and injustice. It's always a pleasure to see you.
Leonard, it is always a pleasure to see you, too.
Money and Class was originally published in 1988. What were your concerns then that prompted you to write that book?
Well, I was trying to free my own mind of a worship of money. Money is the elephant always in the room of the American conversation. I mean, and it is our one abiding value.
Wasn't your grandfather, Lewis Henry Lapham, one of the founders of Texaco?
Yes, there was. And I was brought up in a New England prep school and then Yale College in the 50s.
You didn't have to buy your way in?
I didn't have to buy my way. Well, I don't know. I mean, one of my great uncles bought his way in somewhere around 1920. I mean,
nothing new.
No. But the lecture was from the faculty, you gentlemen are going to inherit the earth, and we want you to have a little culture so you know where you're going to be spending the money.
Right? You buy the right paintings.
And I kept thinking, why do I have to pay this much respect to money? I mean, the more money, if it becomes the supreme value, leads to profound stupidity. I mean, people have known this for thousands of years. I mean, it shows up in the Greek philosophers, it shows up in the Bible. But I was watching it at work in the American society in the 80s. I mean, Reagan was elected, if you remember, in 1980 with the promise that this is going to be, with an agenda not unlike Trump's. I'm going to bring America back to where it was, a country where everybody can always get rich.
But even earlier, the 50s and 60s, when you were growing up, were a time of social and political upheaval, and a number of young people from wealthy families started to reexamine their legacies.
Yes.
Then.
Yes, they did.
Was that something that was discussed in college? Or
well, yes.
Were the good schools you were going to before you went to college?
Not before I went to college, but certainly at college, there was a loyal opposition. There was a sort of a bohemian counterculture avant-garde among the students at Yale in 1952-56. And those became the people that I hung around with, and also on the weekends, I would, instead of going to the football games, I think I only saw one 4 years, but the I would go to the Village, and the, I was interested in jazz. I was studying the piano, and the I had a friend who was a magnificent classmate, a jazz pianist, and he knew everybody in New York. So we'd go down and we'd listen to Monk and
Bud Powell when he came in from France at that time. It was an incredible time to see jazz in New York.
It was, and Eaton, my friend, knew many of these people, but he was also Eaton was also a student of the classical piano. So sometimes we'd go to Carnegie Hall and listen to Richter play the piano.
Now, you mentioned that Ronald Reagan shared many or had many attitudes that were similar to Trump's.
Yeah.
He left office in 1988, and that's when this book was published. Didn't Donald Trump show up at a dinner party thrown by Ann Getty when the book came out?
Yes. I mean, Trump in 1988 was the hero of the age. I mean, he was darling of the media. In 1988, his photograph was on the cover of Time magazine, also on the cover of Playboy magazine. And at Yale in the 80s, students who in the 60s on their walls would have had photographs of Dylan and Che. In 1988, the photograph on the wall was Trump.
Hmm.
And something like half the class of Yale in 1988 applied for jobs at Morgan Stanley.
what was Trump's appeal? That he was rich?
Yeah, that he was rich.
Which he tells us all the time?
Yeah, and that he was the ace of diamonds. I mean, that's the... that's how he was posed on the cover of Time. And so when the book came out, Ann Getty, who was the publisher of the book, she had bought a firm called Weidenfeld & Nicholson, which had contracted the book, and she gave a party in her apartment on Fifth Avenue and invited Trump just because Trump was kind of the best table ornament one could possibly have in 1988.
And what was your take on him at the time?
Well, I mean, he was, my take on him was that he was, I couldn't believe that the extent of the willful ignorance and grotesque vanity. I mean, I listened to him talk at the table and it was embarrassing, but everybody knew that in New York at that time. I mean, the idea that Trump is a surprise, I thought, okay, if this man is the spirit of the age, I figured it was on its final approach to a sell-by date. I mean, this couldn't last. And then I assumed that the entire country in 1988 was wishing for the Midas touch. Everybody wanted to turn themselves into gold, right? I mean, 1988 is the same year as Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of the Vanities and Oliver Stone's Wall Street. And the society was just bewitched by its faith in money.
So are you saying this was the beginning of the process that we have seen developing ever since, or wouldn't it even go back earlier, perhaps, to Barry Goldwater?
Well, it can go back, sure. I mean,
or opposition to the New Deal
when
FDR proposed it.
It does.
We're hearing similar arguments today.
Right, and that was the other platform of Reagan's election, was to take down the whole style of democratic thought and feeling that was the basis of Roosevelt's New Deal. No, the devotion to wealth it recurs in American society over the last 200 odd years. I mean, it's at the first Gilded Age, the one that is described by Thorsten Veblen in his wonderful book, The Theory of the Leisure Class, is equally, and Mark Twain is, you know, coins the phrase Gilded Age in a book that he publishes in 1874. And he says that a society so besotted by greed, a society that adds to nothing more than the sum of its vanity and greed is not a society at all. It is a state of war. That's Twain, 1874.
But historically, haven't Americans insisted that ours is a classless society?
Yes.
Is dynastic wealth growing even more than it did in the past, or are we just seeing it differently?
Well, we've always been a classless. We've always been a class society. I mean, and that was true at the beginning.
Are we a class society?
Yes, certainly. But class in America is defined only in terms of money. I mean, we're not a class society. It's not based on blood or on family and inheritance. It's based on cash. And there have been numbers of books about this, and Cleveland Avery wrote one of the marvelous books about this in the 1950s. You know, you can still, if you're the, you can be a great grandson of a very rich family, but if you've run out of money, you're no longer in the game. You're no longer a member of the club.
But eugenics was once an important part of the way we saw the world.
Yeah.
And in the past, the elite embraced stories of divine right and superiority. Haven't those been replaced now with arguments of biological or genetic superiority? For example, 10 years ago, not all that long ago, Harvard economist Gregory Manco wrote that, quote, smart parents make more money and pass those good genes on to their offspring. And he's made similar claims since. That sounds to me like a new form of eugenics.
Well, that also has been around a long time. I mean, Voltaire, supposed champion of enlightenment human rights, is a very clear white supremacist. I mean, he makes no secret of thinking that white people are superior to black people. I mean, and so that notion of somehow being favored at birth by skin color. I mean that attitude is white supremacy is fundamental to the thinking of Andrew Jackson.
But in this case, the thinking is if your father and mother were wealthy, that means that they were superior, that otherwise they wouldn't have developed that wealth, and so you are born with better genes.
I never got that into that point. I mean, I was born because I was superior because the family could afford to live in Pacific Heights in San Francisco, and the I'm sorry, and it was as simple as that. It really wasn't. I missed the whole eugenics lecture.
I'm speaking with Louis Lapham on Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And I have two books in front of me. One, a reissue of his 1988 book, which suddenly seems incredibly relevant again, called Money and Class in America. And also the latest of his magazine, now almost 10 years old, Lapham's Quarterly, this one devoted to trade, and we'll get into that in a little bit. But the subtitle of the first edition of your book was Notes on Our Civil Religion. What was or is our civil religion?
Well, I mean, I mean, it's the Ambrose Bierce put it. It's the worship of Mammon. It's the almost religious devotion to large sums of wealth. The idea that a rich man, because he is rich, is also wise. I mean, the love of money is all over the world. I mean, it's not a unique American
in fact,
attribute.
Inequality is growing around the world. Has the American view of money and wealth been an influence?
Yes, certainly. I would think so. Yes, I mean, we've made it very clear that that's our supreme value. I mean, our whole consumer society is built on that idea, on the pursuit of happiness. The pursuit of happiness, happiness as defined in the 18th century, when Jefferson puts it into the Declaration of Independence, is defined as power, pleasure, and profit. That's the understanding of the word happiness in the 18th century.
So we can actually trace a lot of what we're talking about back to the founding fathers.
Oh yeah, no question about it. I mean the freedom. Well, when they talk about liberty. The phrase is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. But by liberty, they mean what the British economic philosopher John Locke meant. It was liberty for property, not liberty for persons. The idea of liberty for persons just does not occur to the founders of the American Republic. I mean,
and they spent, as they were debating the Constitution, the founders paid special attention to issues of property and debt.
Yes. Yes.
Would you say they inherited from British thinkers?
Yeah, they did.
Even though the whole idea was to break with everything British.
Well, yes, but also to acquire British property. Mm-hmm. Not to walk away empty-handed from that break.
And of course, they were also defending slavery.
They talk about constitutional, I mean, they talk about all men being created equal, but they didn't. They believed that in theory, but not in practice. I mean, I was writing about this the other day, and I came across a quotation by Cotton Mather talking to his to the lesser folk in the congregation in Cambridge or Boston, where he says to the indentured servants in the midst, he said, "You are slaves. I own your hands, and your feet are mine." Or your master's, not mine. Mm-hmm. Franklin didn't feel that the people in Philadelphia were equal. I mean, he thought of the rummaging in the scrap heap of what the early founders called waste people. These are people that came over as indentured servants from. Swept out of the sewers of London.
But everywhere, the first Africans who were brought here as indentured servants. Slavery was instituted a little later.
Yeah, no.
As an extension of that.
Yeah, I mean.
They couldn't buy their way out as they indentured servants could.
Yeah. And the opening of the settlement of the West in the first half of the 19th century, the West is understood as a safety valve where to get rid of possibly dangerous black people.
It's interesting that Benjamin Rush, I don't know if you know Rush, he was an anomaly. He was an abolitionist. He was for equal rights for women. He was for free medical treatment of the poor and keeping the poor areas clean so that disease wouldn't spread. But he was a lone voice.
No.
Obviously, people it occurred to people.
Tom Paine also. Mm-hmm. It occurs
and they collaborated, Tom Paine and Ben Rush.
When Paine first comes to America at the invitation of Franklin to become a journalist, I mean, the first newspaper columns written arguing for equal rights for women and freedom for the slaves are by Paine. But he's a friend of Rush.
You have a shocking photograph in the current issue of Lapham's Quarterly, of Price, Birch & Company's building. It says Price, Birch & Company, dealers in slaves.
Right. No, it was a big business, and it was run that way, and people were not shy about advertising the John
This
Locke.
Is from Virginia.
You know, yeah, but John Locke himself, the British economic philosopher, was a major stockholder in the largest slave trading corporation running out of Liverpool.
Now, after your book came out in 1988, Reagan's presidency was followed by George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, Barack Obama, and now Donald Trump. How much has changed over those 30 years?
I don't think much. I mean, I think the Brandeis, Justice Brandeis appointed, in the 1920s by Supreme Court Justice, says to Franklin Roosevelt in 1932, we can have...
Can I give you the exact quote? Because I've written it down.
Yes, read it down.
He wrote, "We must make our choice. We may have democracy, or we may have wealth concentrated in the hands of a few, but we can't have both."
He's right, and that was understood as far back in our history. John Adams says almost the same thing to Jefferson in their correspondence. In the first decades of the 19th century, and this is recognized. I mean,
haven't we had both since the beginning of this country?
We've tried to find a balance. What the founders are trying to do with the Constitution is to balance a democratic society with a capitalist economy. That's a hard thing to do, and it requires people willing to pay attention. And Madison says that it's a government by people with the most wisdom to discern and the most virtue to pursue the common good of the society. And he expressed the thought that there would be a constant tinkering with this mechanism. And there have been times in the history of the country when we have tinkered with it. The New Deal is one point.
And FDR came out of wealth.
Yeah.
So was he being a traitor to his class?
There were many people that accused him of that. I mean, they were. I can still remember my elders. I'm born in 1935, and I grew up in San Francisco during World War II, and I can still hear some of my, fathers and grandfather's generation talking, as did the Republican opposition to the New Deal. I mean, still talking about Roosevelt as, a communist. I mean, there's always been this kind of an opposition in
actually,
in
he was country. He was trying to come up with a corrective inequality in our societies to save capitalism.
That's correct. That's correct.
You're right. And now that that Trump's quote, and I'm quoting you, smug and self-satisfied face is the face of the way things are and have been in Washington and Wall Street for the last quarter of a century. What happened 35 years ago in 1994? Does Newt Gingrich play a part in this story?
No, I mean, it's the Trump didn't read Brandeis. He didn't read politics. I mean,
well, we know he doesn't read.
He doesn't read. So, but he was never in any doubt that money is the good, true, and beautiful. And my point is that same assumption was shared by H.W. Bush, by Clinton, by G.W. Bush, and by Obama, and by Trump. I mean, we haven't had a new way in the last 30 or 40 years of thinking about the relation between between the rich and the poor. I mean, it's that simple.
Common argument is that people like Trump, Bloomberg, Whitman, Fiorina, were successful in business, so they know how to run things. And Trump bragged that he's really rich.
I know he did, and when George W. Bush became president, he said he's going to run it like a corporation. The problem is that it doesn't work that way. I mean, politics is not business. I mean, it's a different skill, and the if you try to run it like a business, you end up with what we've got now, which is a plutocracy. I mean, business is always going to make the decision in favor of the bottom line. I mean, you cannot run a society or hold together a polity if all you've got is the doctrine of the bottom line.
Louis Lapham is my guest today, and we have two things that we are considering: a reissue of his book, Money and Class in America, with a new foreword by Thomas Frank, who has wondered in his own work what's happened to America, especially in the Midwest. And also the latest edition of Lapham's Quarterly, with the Spring 2019 edition, which is headed trade, because each one of the magazines focuses on a different topic?
Yes, the magazine is, we've been doing it for 10 years. It's a quarterly, it's a very beautiful object. I think you will agree to that.
I see it as a collection of essays, many of them by the great thinkers of past 2,000 years, but not necessarily well-known ones, with really interesting sidebars and great illustrations.
Yeah.
Sounds like a pretty good combination.
Well, yeah. I think it is. It's 224 pages, and there's no advertising, and it's a perfect spine, and it's filled with illustration, art, painting, sculpture, photography, taken over the past. It's a compendium of texts taken from or focused on a topic that's in the news. In other words, we've done issues on death, religion, money, war.
You don't think you're going to run out of topics?
No, we're not going to run out of topics. And the current one is trade, and the idea is to bring to bear on the topic in the news as to where we are now, with to bring us up to date with the story so far.
So, but you go all the way back to Cicero.
We go, sure,
Pliny
we go,
the Elder.
We go back to Pliny the Elder. We go back to Cicero. In this issue on trade, we have Joseph Conrad, Max Weber, Francis Rabelais, Fernand Braudel, Eduardo Galeano, David Ricardo. I mean, Hilary Mantel. I mean, the writing is uniformly good. I don't have to agree or disagree with what anybody's saying. It's just that it has to be written well and that it is all focused on whatever the point is under discussion. So there are a lot of different sides of the argument.
And we come back to globalization, because so much of the story of trade has been about globalization, whether it was the Chinese, whether it was all the trade, the spice trade and the like from the Middle East, whether it was the Colombian exchange that Spain and Portugal brought about that really changed European history.
Yes.
Africa, the colonization of Africa.
Right.
All of that has played a major role in how politics are conducted today.
Without any question. I mean, it's played a major role in how politics have been conducted for the last 4,000 years. I mean, the Trojan War is a trade war. So
I just thought they were horsing around.
Yeah.
Now, you don't take advertising, and I've been asked to mention that you have a fundraiser coming up, a fundraising gala.
Yeah.
The Decades Ball.
That's true.
On the 25th of this month. One-word plug before we move on back to the topics at hand?
Well, we give the annual ball every year, and we take a different decade. We've taken the 1780s. We've taken the 1590s. We're taking the 1920s, and this year it's the 1960s.
And why not take advertising? I know why WBAI doesn't take advertising. Same reason? You don't want to be influenced?
No, it's not worth it. I mean, our circulation is roughly 40,000, which is a large circulation for this kind of a magazine. But you can't make any money with it. It isn't worth the trouble. I mean, the advertisers only pay substantial money for very large circulation.
Right. They want a million.
Yeah.
A million readers.
Yeah.
You open your preamble in the current issue of the magazine with a quote from Hannah Arendt, who was writing this 50 years ago, although it sounds like it could have been written today. Quote, "In the era of imperialism, businessmen became politicians and were acclaimed as statesmen, while statesmen were taken seriously only if they talked the language of successful businessmen." The difference is, do the business leaders even have to be particularly successful these days?
Well, they have to at least pretend to be.
Claim that they're very rich.
But that goes back to the point that you made earlier about, running a country like a business or running a country like a corporation. We got into that habit because of the amount of wealth we were producing and prosperity. And it doesn't really give you very many. It doesn't produce a healthy politics if you try to run it as a business.
Well, many members of Congress, many politicians throughout the country are wealthier than average Americans.
That's been true for at least 40 years.
So how well can they represent average Americans when their own circumstances are so different? And we're talking about a bipartisan situation. Democrats like Richard Blumenthal and Dianne Feinstein, are very, very wealthy. In fact, they are among a group. Half the collective net worth of Congress is held by about 12 members, and they are among those.
Yeah, I know. Well, it makes it hard for them to understand their fellow citizens, because if you, I mean, one of the problems with our politics is that, and this was another reason that Trump got elected, is the disconnect between the permanent government in Washington, which is run a government by and for the rich, and that's been true for quite a long time. And the so the Dianne Feinsteins of the world tend not to know who their fellow Americans are. They have more in common with their rich counterparts in London or Paris or Berlin or Dubai than they do with their somebody they like to meet on the wrong side of town.
But they often are reelected. Upstate New York Representative Chris Collins is worth over $40 million, and he was reelected last November despite having been arrested on insider trading charges last August. So I guess...
Well, I mean, you know, again, we think that, I mean, to be rich is to be a celebrity. So maybe the... I have no idea why he's getting elected. I can see why Trump got elected. Trump got elected by saying the only thing that counts is money, and money is power, and it's not democratic.
And one explanation for his success with his base is, even though they recognize that he has many faults because they've been in the news, they see him as a game changer, and they feel that what he's going to do will change things permanently, and then they can get somebody that they feel a little more comfortable with in the future.
Yes, no, the press loved him. I mean, the press made him. I mean, you have to understand that the you remember Leslie Moombs or whatever his name is, the CBS guy. He was talking in the primaries, and he said that Trump may be bad for the country, but he's very, very good for CBS.
Yes.
I mean, so the press made a fortune out of money, out of Trump, and they played him as a lone gunslinger type figure. I mean, they kind of put him in the same category with Clint Eastwood or the great robber barons. So the guys coming out of nowhere to fix up the crooked sheriff and clean up the town and distribute justice and clear the swamp and so forth, right? I mean, he had no intention of doing that, but that's the... That was the mythos of his election campaign.
A friend and admirer of President Trump sent him a handwritten note opening with, "Dear King." Have any polls been conducted to determine whether there is much sentiment for a monarchy in this country, or is that just a subtext?
Well, that is a subtext. I mean, I published a group of essays, you know, 10 or 15 years ago called The Wish for Kings. And as the other thing that has been going on for the last 40-odd years is the loss of faith in democracy. Democracy isn't up to the task of cleaning up the world or defending us against our enemies or, you know, keeping the trains on time. I mean, there's never, I mean, to make a perfect democracy is hopeless, but with the, because it's so difficult. But the idea you're going to try for that idea is it's the aspiration more than it is the fact in itself. I mean, power all power is corrupt, but some power must govern. I mean, what's happened, I think, in the United States and it's happening elsewhere in the world is the loss of faith in the notion of democratic government. It's not efficient enough. It can't protect us.
So that's why we're seeing this neo-fascist movement in much of Europe.
Well, yeah, but that is the wish for
Brazil
kings.
Brazil as well.
That's the wish for kings.
Now, Judge T.S. Ellis III sentenced Paul Manafort to what many consider a very light sentence for a string of guilty verdicts. And he claimed that Manafort had led a blameless life before committing his crimes. Does rich make right in the United States? Somebody joked that the sentence would have been a lot harsher if the defendant's name had been Kwame Manafort or Juan Manafort.
Well, I mean, I think that there is a different distribution of justice, just the way there is a different distribution of wealth, and I think that the distributions fall along more or less the same lines. You can say that the rule of law in the United States is the divine right of money.
Well, things seem to have changed. The growing number of changes and reforms made in the decades after World War II, including LBJ's Great Society, have been reversed since the Reagan administration, since you wrote this book.
I'm not sure which.
Well, little by little, we had so-called welfare reform. We had all sorts of other things that much of LBJ's Great Society is being undercut. And
yes,
now there's talk of getting rid of Medicare. And
yes, that's right. Yeah. No, that's.
Now, considering your own family background, do you think that the U.S. needs to implement something like the wealth tax that's been suggested by Elizabeth Warren, or a top marginal tax rate of 70% as proposed by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez? I'm thinking back to, wasn't the top rate quite high during the post-World War II economic boom? I think it was up to 90%.
It was 90%. And I can remember my own family being very content with that.
Well, there were a lot of loopholes, so nobody actually paid 90%.
Yes, there were a lot of loopholes, but it was understood that that kind of a tax was fair. So I think there should be some sort of tax on whatever you decide to be excessive wealth.
Some economists like Joseph Stiglitz and Amartya Sen have argued that the commonly used sense of wealth as GDP is too narrow. Do we need to change our conception of wealth?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing we have to do if we're going to because capitalism left to its own devices will destroy the earth. I mean, yes, so no, we do. And the great speech about that was made.
Well, climate change, by the way, may destroy the world. Well, and many of the arguments by climate change deniers are based on capitalist assumptions.
But
am I wrong?
Wait a minute.
But because you would say it hurts business, it's.
Oh yeah, sure. That's right. And yes. Bobby Kennedy made a very fine speech along these lines, I think, in some, you know, like 1964 or earlier, I think in Kansas City, and he was talking about GDP. What does GDP really mean? And I mean, it doesn't count for any of the things that make people healthy, wealthy, and wise. I mean, it doesn't count imagination. It doesn't count mind, it doesn't count art, it doesn't count work. I mean, the kind of work in which people find meaning, it's based on a system of double bookkeeping that was invented in the late 15th century by an Italian monk. And the, it was like...
It goes back that far.
It goes back, and we're still using it.
No, you write... You write that the rich are increasingly frightened.
I think so.
In one of his books, Joseph Stiglitz described hearing wealthy guests at a party speculate about the return of the guillotine. Haven't many Americans across the economic spectrum come to accept this extreme inequality?
I think so. I mean, I think
when
that's
people aren't marching in the streets.
No, but they Americans have always been kind of expectant capitalists. I mean, we're not going to plunder the rich because we live in the hope that we ourselves will get rich. If you see what I mean. I mean, that's been, we too will hit the lottery, or we, or we'll make an app that'll make us rich. I mean, but recently the rich have been pushing it a little too far. I mean, you know, the gated communities, the surveillance cameras, the emphasis, the word public used to infer a kind of common good. I mean, when I was growing up in the 50s and into the 60s, public spirit, public servants, public square, right? And private was a word that was associated with pigs at troughs and you know, Wall Street guys with top hats and big bellies and so on. And the meaning reversed in the 70s.
And do you know why? Was it just...
Yes, I know why, because the... Well, I don't know why. I don't know anything, but I can guess, right? Because what happens in the 70s is you have a real
Richard
break.
Nixon becomes president, but he gives us the EPA, he gives us the Clean Water Act, and...
I know, but I mean, what's going on in the society is a real revolution. I mean, a revolution in terms of gender. Communities are breaking up. Jobs are being set. I mean, this is when the community values begin to lose force. And the idea that there was no history, that was another idea that came out of the 60s. There's been nobody...
The end of history.
Yeah, and the end of history. And there's a feeling of rootlessness that takes hold, and the only value left the only port in the storm seems to be money. I mean, that happens in the 70s, if you remember. And so I forget where this started, but the drifting apart of, you know, private and public. I mean, all of a sudden, private becomes the true, the good, and the beautiful, and public becomes disease, foreigners, you know, public toilet, and so on. I mean, it, and that was not helped by Reagan, who's constantly talking about breaking down the government and the government's incompetent. And
privatization was going to bring more efficiency to government.
Yeah.
Because businesses run more efficiently than government.
Yeah.
But it hasn't turned out that way.
No, but it's made a certain kind of, you know, it's made the financial powers extremely, extremely rich.
Now, you also quote Joseph Conrad, one of my favorite writers, in the spring issue of your quarterly. In his great 1904 novel Nostromo, the American industrialist Holroyd says, I'm quoting, "Time itself has got to wait on the greatest country in the whole of God's universe. We shall be giving the word for everything, industry, trade, law, journalism, art, politics, and religion. we shall run the world's business whether the world likes it or not.
Right.
Could time be on the verge of giving up on the world's only indispensable nation?
Yes, it
is. Now that China is gaining on it?
Yes. And the other thing that's happening, I mean, I use that to introduce the essay in the trade issue. I talk about, I quote that from Conrad. And I also quote the Hannah Arendt. And then I go to the this winter issue of Foreign Affairs, mm-hmm. which is devoted to the question, who runs the world, right? And so you have a lot of concerned bankers and economists and politicians, even Elizabeth Warren is in the issue, bemoaning the fact that they no longer run the world.
And because, why should anybody run the world?
I'm well, the point, yeah. That's another. Well, again, you go back to American history and you go back to the idea of the infinite future. I'm reading a book now by a guy named Greg Grandin about the myth of the American frontier. Mm. And the idea was that we were continually going to expand. It was always moving, getting bigger and bigger and bigger. I mean, until we were going to run the world. I mean, that kind of idea is not only in the head of Jackson in the 1830s, but it's also in the head of Jefferson.
By the way, that book, he's going to come on our show.
Oh, you'll like that book. Yeah. It's a good one. He's going to come on my show, too.
Now, we should mention that you have a podcast. How do people find your podcast?
Through the website for the quarterly. But again, I mean, you bring up these questions with Grandin because he really does a lovely job of it in this book.
We'll plan to. That's why we booked him on the show. We, as you've noticed, we have a full hour to actually get into these topics in a rather deep way. In the little time that we have left, the big question is, could climate change prove to be the fly in everybody's ointment?
Yes, I think it can. I mean, I think it can offer enough evidence of a need for change. It can force a redrafting of our relation between man and nature.
But it's being used. It's been a polarizing thing in politics right now.
I know it has.
And supporters of a new green approach are being ridiculed.
Well, not entirely. I mean, I saw there have been a couple of columns that have said, excuse me, this goes too far, this is too extreme, it's not thought out, but at least these people are beginning to raise questions that have to be raised. I mean, I don't know what the bill looks like, or it's not a bill, it's a resolution proposed by Markey and AOC, but my sense of it is that so far it's rhetoric without much reality to it. You got to start somewhere.
Yes, yeah. And the UN has tried to push it. There was the Paris Accord, and none of that seems to be having much of an effect.
It's much harder to do than one thinks. I mean, it's not something that can be solved by politics or by technology. It's something that has to be, it entails a change of heart and a change of mind. It's a cultural question. I mean, we have to have a new idea of what we mean by politics, what we mean by American, what do we mean by civilization? I mean, all those words are up for reconsideration.
And I wonder, in just the my last question, you're in the Editor's Hall of Fame, I guess. Do you think of yourself first as an editor or as a writer? Or?
Well, I think of myself as a writer. I became editor of the magazine, of Harper's Magazine, a long time ago in 1975, because I then took up writing a column every month, and I thought, okay, this gives me a chance to learn, educate myself in public, and writing the column. And because I wasn't having to adjust it, what I was thinking to fit some other editor's ideas, I mean, I learned to make my own mistakes.
Lewis Lapham's 1988 book, Money and Class in America, has just been reissued in paperback by O.R. with a foreword by Thomas Frank and a new introduction by the author. There's also the latest issue of Lapham's Quarterly, Spring 2019, devoted to trade. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Leonard, thank you for having me. I love your show.
And that does bring us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Lewis Lapham, to Hugh Sansom, who produced today's segment, to my producer, Jesse Lent, who was at the audio controls today, and to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music. Special thanks to Kevin O'Donohue, Nasima, and Alex Lopez, and the Positive Mind Center for allowing us to use their first-rate studio facilities. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.